I'm Steve Hitchcock, and I live in Albany, California, which is a town that's 6 blocks wide. It goes from San Francisco Bay up until the foothills in the Bay Area, right next door to Berkeley. And my topic tonight is money. Does God read financial statements? I've put my name and address on the bulletin board up there. I do answer my mail, and in 55 minutes we probably won't answer all your questions or exhaust all your concerns. And I do answer my mail, and I'd be glad to carry on our conversation over the mail. And obviously I'm here for the rest of the week, and hope you'll feel free to stop me at any time and say I disagree with you, or what about this, or let's talk some more. I'd be glad to talk with you. I've also listed 2 resources that might be of interest to you. Some of you may even know Michael Phillips. Does anyone know Michael Phillips?
From Eureka.
Ah.
I read his book.
Yeah.
Is he from Eureka?
Yes, I think so. He was a banker in San Francisco and hung out with the hippies during the 60s, and he developed some really important concepts in marketing for banks, and ended up helping. Some really good book. He wrote another book called Honest Business, which if anyone runs a small business, is a very helpful, practical book. The other resource that's listed there is Ministry of Money. Church of Our Savior in Washington, D.C., which some of you may know. That's one of the ministries that grew out of that church. And they publish a very helpful newsletter, which you may receive free of charge if you wish. And I encourage you to contact them if you wish. Well, let me just say that my topic is money tonight. And I have to say that this is a group learning situation. Tell you one little story that will, I hope, introduce what I want to talk about. About 2 years ago, when I was still managing a small publishing company in San Francisco, which was a for-profit company, and we were growing rapidly and dealing with all the problems that small businesses have, both financial and personnel and all the other fun that some of you may know about firsthand, the Episcopalians heard that I had some religious inclination. And so they asked me to come and speak to a conference that they had on Saturday down in the peninsula, which is about an hour and a half drive from my house. And as in most modern families, we sort of pass as we run in the halls trying to keep our schedules between soccer and music lessons and jobs, and somehow trying to get something on the dinner table to eat at night. So my wife Jan didn't know what I was doing, but just that I was going somewhere on Saturday. So I roll out of bed at 5 o'clock, and Jan charitably wakes up just enough to say, "By the way, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to go talk to the Episcopalians about balancing your personal, family, and business life." And as I drove down the peninsula that next hour and a half, I could hear on my head the echo of the laughter. I have that same problem when it comes to money. At the end of the month, the checkbook is always empty, if not overdrawn. The credit cards always have too much on them. And it always seems at the end of the year that all of that money that you earned and reported on your tax form, you have no sense at all where in the world it all went. Well, that's just to preface what I want to say today. I'm willing, on the issue of money, 3 things are of key interest to me, and I'm willing to focus our conversation together on either of any of those. One is, what does it mean in terms of being a business person or an employee of an organization? How do finances affect the management and operation of those businesses and institutions in our society? One of my assumptions is that there is too much ignorance about the role of money in the operation of congregations, small businesses, large businesses, and nonprofit organizations. The second topic that I'm keenly interested in when it comes to money is personal finance. How do we as individual Christians deal with the reality of the empty checkbook at the end of each month? What do we do about taxes? What about investments that don't work and do work? Are there some unique perspectives that we have as Christians because of that? And the third area that's of key interest to me, primarily because that's the way I make my living these days, is the issue of fundraising, also called charitable giving, philanthropy, how nonprofit organizations in our country live. It is a $70+ billion industry a year. 50%, almost 50% of that $70 billion goes to churches. And so it's something that all of us in some way are intimately involved in. Those are the three topics that I find especially interesting and I'm willing to talk about today if you wish. But what I'd like to do is spend time talking about what you're interested in about money. And so I'd like to take some time now just to get a sense of what you want to talk about. I can talk even faster than I'm talking now. And as some of you who know me who are in this room, I'm arrogant enough to have an opinion about anything. So let's do that. Let me just say that I've found in working with, for good or for ill, I've had the chance to work with lots of groups. And I found that there are three things that are really helpful when you're trying to learn as a large group, because it is a fun way to learn. But one is to be brief, because that makes it possible for other people to speak. Secondly, to listen to other persons. And that's really in your best interest, because when somebody is listened to, they speak more quickly. People who ramble on and on tend to be people who don't have the sense of being listened to. So if we all listen to those who speak, they will speak more briefly. And thirdly, one of the other delightful things that helps a group work is to realize that you don't have to disagree with everyone. And even if that this may not be the appropriate context to always have an argument against something. Sometimes it's nice just to have lots of different perspectives floating around unassailed for a little while and deal with them later. So, given that, what would you folks like to talk about tonight? Let's just take about 5 minutes and list some of the things about money that are of concern and interest to you. I can write quickly, too.
Well, tithing.
Tithing. What else?
Motivation.
Motivation.
Forgiving.
Anything else? Yes, please.
How about the sense of ownership when it comes to people participating in Christian giving?
Okay. Could you say just another word about that? What does that mean for you?
When we give as Christians, we don't always know what's in it for us, so to speak.
Ah, okay.
How is it happening? I turn it over, but what are they doing with it?
Okay. What's happening to my money?
Well, how can you impart that to people so that certainly that can become a much more productive part of your giving?
Good point.
How about rationale for getting?
Explain that for me.
Well,
rationale for getting means...
Everybody seems to be a little hesitant to say, well, I want more, but should I?
Okay. As, say just a little bit more, rationale for getting as individuals,
yes,
in terms of our personal income?
Right.
Okay.
Well, let's face it, we'd all like a little bit more money.
Okay. Good. Other topics. There's lots of time tonight.
Personal investments along with church investments.
Okay. Are those two separate topics or related in your mind?
Well, make it two separate topics.
Okay.
I
Other areas of concern, yes, please. Tax benefits, good.
Memorial Fund Foundation.
Oh, okay. The topic there that was listed was Memorial Fund Foundations. And what you must be referring to is people who give memorials, and some congregations and organizations set up separate foundations to manage the investment and disbursement of those funds.
Will, request, so on.
Yes, please.
Could you relate the memorial fund to the tax benefits?
Sure. Okay. How does that tie, how do memorial funds tie in with tax benefits? Okay. Yeah.
How about avoidance? Jail now by evasion.
How do you evade or avoid taxes?
Hire a CPA.
Hire a CPA. This is the rationale for getting more income, and this is for, there's two simple answers to both of these. One is that you have to work harder, the other is you have to make less. So, yes, please.
How about our personal management of your own funds?
Okay. Personal management of funds, good point. Since I confess my own inability at that, you could talk about it. Yes, please.
Tom, my name about that, a family of four a minimum budget or a minimum income.
Okay. Minimum budget.
Family of four with a growing bill and things.
Okay. Yes, please.
Some discussion of the morality or the ethic involved in the amount that our society has as opposed to others.
Okay.
Consumption and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. The ethic of the consumption patterns given global scarcities are.
Well, and it also relates to the desire for more income.
Sure. Okay. Yes, please.
How can we find out which charitable organizations use most of the money for service rather than for their own pocket?
Okay. How charitable organizations use the money that we contributed.
How do we find out?
If you live in New York, it's easy because they all have to file statements. And I think a good rule of thumb is that if a charitable nonprofit organization isn't willing to share its financial statement with you, that's a pretty good indication to me that there are some problems. Most good organizations are going to be audited anyway in order to get grants, and therefore those financial statements should be available if you're truly concerned about that. Maybe just say one more thing. Maybe this sounds like it is a personal defense, but it is a good defense because born out of 15 years of experience. Most nonprofit organizations do a very good job of using the money that they earn. In fact, most nonprofit organizations don't spend enough money raising money. So I think that you can err on the side of not worrying about that issue, but it is a concern in specific instances. Well, other topics and concerns?
Budget. Both personal and in the congregation.
Good point. Anything else? Well, we've got about 40 minutes. Maybe 40 minutes. We can do it. And even if we don't, we can talk about those things later, or I hope that what we talk about relates in some way to these topics. And we'll take a minute just at the end to check to see if there are any questions that didn't get answered at all. Let me just say a word at the beginning, because Elmer Witt introduced this as a discussion of the ministry of the laity. And I think it'd be helpful just to take a moment to set this in some sort of context, and you might want to respond to that context. Let me just say that I'm a Lutheran, but my father was a Methodist, and we became Lutherans because he discovered in Long Beach, California, the town that I was born and raised, reared in, that the Lutherans had the best softball team. So he made a great doctrinal stand back in the 1949, and therefore, obviously with a name like Hitchcock, I am mostly of English parentage. But what that means is that in my family, we grew up with the Methodist piety of John Wesley, that you do good when you can, where you can, and how you can, but with the Lutheran theology that says that we're saved by grace, by faith, and somehow things all work out even though we've messed things up. That's not a very helpful definition of ministry, but it's certainly one that's at another level practical. I do think that there is the ministry of the laity. And as most of us know, laos in the New Testament means people, and it means people of God, those people who have been baptized into the people, into the community. What that means is that everyone, and I believe this very strongly, everyone is a layperson. Some of those laypersons have been set aside, have been ordained, if you will, for specific functions for the benefit of the ministry that all of us perform. What that means is that those persons who are called clergy share a common ministry with us, and secondly, that those persons also have a ministry as lay persons, that even if you're a clergyman or a clergywoman, you have to deal with domestic responsibilities, you have to deal with money, you have to learn how to run an office. Even if you don't, you should. So I think that there is a ministry that we all have and share. I work with an organization as a volunteer called New Models for Ministry, and what we talk about is not the ministry of the laity, but ministry in everyday life. That everyday life is the context in which the ministry that we have is carried out. One more thing about ministry. Ministry, in my view, is that is what the people of God do. If you are baptized, you are in ministry. Ministry is not something we have to plan to do. Ministry is something that we are already doing. And the task that we have as Christians is to nurture, to strengthen, to reflect upon, and to renew that ministry that we are already carrying out. Each of us in this room is doing ministry. Well, having said that, let's talk a little bit about how that relates to some of the issues. Talked about. I see, let me just take a look here, that there are, as I look at this, the two major issues are charitable giving and personal money management. And so let's try to touch on both of those. And on the charitable giving aspect, I see two ways to look at that. One is from the perspective of the giver, and the other is from the perspective of a nonprofit organization, or more specifically in terms of the congregation. Let's take nonprofits first, and charitable giving. As I said before, there, more than $70 billion each year is being given away to nonprofit organizations. Almost 90% of that comes from individuals. Corporations and foundations give about 5%. Foundations a little bit more than corporations. So individuals are giving most of the money. Poor people, people who are statistically poor, according to the government averages, give almost $300 per year. So that even poor people, what we call poor folks, are contributing significant sums of money each year to churches and to other organizations. Why are they doing that? Someone said, what's the motivation for giving? Why are people tithing? How do we develop some ownership in that giving? And the whole issue of memorial fund foundations, which I think is tremendously important here, and whether or not taxes have anything to do about that. I have a picture that helps some of the people that I work with understand why people give money, and I think it's helpful. The first picture is a necklace. And let's start from the perspective of the donor or the church member who's giving. All of us have some financial resources, one of the beads on this necklace, money that we have available to contribute to our parish, to other organizations that we care about. All of us have a unique set of interests and experiences. No matter how hard we try in our society to make everyone alike, to all wear the same esprit clothes, we somehow end up differently. We all have a different background and come from it. I found in working with people in the last 15 years that as hard as we try, sometimes those interests and experiences, those patterns of behavior, really do grow out of deeply held values and beliefs. How we act really does reflect what we hold dear in life. What are the principles that we have serve as bedrock in our life? So those are the three beads on the donor side. Let's go over to the nonprofit organization or to your congregation. Every organization needs money. There are financial needs that they have. This one doesn't work anymore. The reason they need money, why do they need money?
Carry out the work.
Carry out the work. Somebody else had?
Pay the pastor.
Pay the pastor. Why do we have a pastor?
Spread the word.
Spread the word. Every organization has activities, some work that they do. Sometimes we call it programs. Whatever it is, those things take money to do. That's the real world. Pastors can't live on nothing. They have to be paid. You can't operate a building like this without some financial resources. Why do we carry out this work? What's the reason for those activities?
God's witness.
Okay.
It ties back into our values and beliefs.
Ah, okay. As some of you may know who are in business, one of the big discoveries of the last decade is that those organizations that are successful have what we call in the church a mission, a overarching purpose to witness to the Christ who has redeemed our lives, the bedrock values and beliefs. What this says is then that fundraising, or the act of giving, then is the clasp on this necklace. That when we make a contribution, to an organization that we care about. We are acting out of our beliefs and values, expressing our particular interests and experiences, and using our financial resources to give to that organization that makes it possible to do the activities and work, and therefore fulfill the mission that resonates with our values and beliefs. To me, this says two things that are very important, and things that we've learned in working with lots of different organizations. Those organizations that are most effective in raising money, which is one of the reasons why churches get almost 50% of all nonprofit money, have a strong sense of mission, strong sense of purpose. Secondly, those organizations that are effective are able to focus on the interests and experiences to develop that sense of ownership that you talked about. One of the things that is very difficult in church fundraising is that we all work with the idea of a common budget, unified budget you give to the church in general. The problem is that we all come with bundles of specific interests and experiences. We need those buttons, if you will push responsive cords. That's why memorial funds work so well. Because we have an interest in remembering and paying tribute to those loved ones who have died. And therefore, we're able, through memorial giving, to do that. That's why it's always so easy to build buildings in fundraising, because there is a specific interest and experience that's being tapped in someone. And it's also why it's easy to raise scholarship money, because there is an individual, at least in our mind's eye, that young person that we're making it possible to do. Is that a helpful drawing for you? Does that help answer some of the questions that we talked about in terms of motivation? I think what I've learned is that that means that you can never trick anyone into giving. None of us can be forced to do that, because it operates out of such a value-laden system. The other thing is that it's very, very difficult to raise money among young people. Why would that be? Pardon?
No value.
Right.
No money. No money.
They haven't had the experience.
Pardon? You disagree?
I sure do.
Okay, go ahead.
Put down of young people. I think it's more fair to say their values are different.
Okay.
Or formative, anyway.
Their values are formative. Yes. I think what statistically it is true that money comes above 55 and above, statistically, in terms of that. The other thing that is true is that I think we do know from psychology and human development that reflectiveness about values at the intensity that seems to trigger this kind of giving comes at after age 35. There is that sense of mortality that most of us develop after age 35 that seems to fuel this concern for values and beliefs and the ability to pass on those values and beliefs. Jan and I are involved in several nonprofit organizations that are concerned with conservation. We can't, on our own, with our own resources, plant enough trees to save the planet. But by adding our contributions to other folks, we're able to accomplish that by participating with others. And I think that that does take some maturity for that to happen. Yes?
I was thinking about that statistic about young people. Is it, do you live with that, or do you try to educate then younger people? See, what you're saying is that maybe you're just going to accept that as a hard fact, or maybe there's an education program to start. Maybe that's an untapped field.
Yeah, go ahead. In response to that.
Well, having worked here for almost 16 months and seen a lot of young people come and go. We talk to a lot of young people. They don't give their money, they give their time. And a lot of them don't have the money to give, but they do have the time to give. And that's what I have seen. I haven't seen them give the money because they don't really have the money. They really give themselves.
Yeah.
This seems to be a real pattern today.
I think I misunderstood you. You said money comes after 55?
No, statistically, the greatest percentage of money is given by people who are 55 years and older.
Statistically, most people that are 55 and older are the ones that die, too.
Right.
So you can't really look at that. I think that's just where the money is. The money doesn't reside in that under that age.
Well, the discretionary income doesn't. Yes. There are demographic reasons why that is the case, in addition to value reasons. But the presence of money and the presence of tax benefits will not equal charitable giving. There are a lot better ways to invest his money than giving to charitable organizations, even with the most sexy tax benefits that some nonprofits are going to do. So it's just not the availability of discretionary income, nor the passing of people, the death of people. Only 7% of people have wills anyway. So most people are giving their money to the state. So that. I'm sorry, you had a...
Well, I was thinking that though the money is not with the young people, the availability to help do some of the work that's on the other side of your necklace...
Yes, very good point.
The more you can involve in doing the work, the more you'll help shape the value so that when the money is there, you can get it.
Yes. We do know that charitable giving is a learned habit. You interview some people who are charitable givers. The experience they will talk about is seeing other people give money.
I guess I look at it more from the belief point of your chart there. And as a Christian, it's clearly stated that we're supposed to tithe. Mm-hmm. So that if you take it from the basic point of belief of Jesus as Lord and Savior to the next point of tithing, and if we teach that, then it's not a matter of our value system or how much we're earning, but if we look in terms of tithing as the model, God's model, and go from there, then I think we approach it from a different issue.
Good point.
Another question.
Okay.
I think that the value there is the value of that you learn in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you tithe. You're not tithing from blind faith. You're tithing because you have a certain value that lends you to tithe.
I'm talking about 10% now.
Okay.
Do we have statistics on Lutherans? I'm a Presbyterian, so I can answer that.
I used to...
I got bad news for you, the Presbyterian...
I know they're bad.
What's the per capita per Lutheran? I think it's...
2%.
2%. Nationally, it's just over 1%. Americans contribute just over 1% of their income each year to nonprofit organizations. 2%. I was thinking of a dollar figure. Isn't it in the 600s someplace? I haven't kept track of all of those. I try not to have too many church clients. yes.
Perhaps differently would be that taxes are given. What we can do to minimize our taxes with our own power is perhaps maybe objective for us.
Mm-hmm.
As far as tithing, though, I think you shouldn't consider taxes as a tithe. Taxes are made for roads and for all those good things that everybody uses. And I have a problem when you consider taxes and tithing to be one thing.
But it is true that back 1,500 years ago, when there wasn't any significant tax in many countries, there were ways in which the poor were supported through charitable giving. That now in some instances the government has taken over. And that's the point he was making. And tithing then, 1,500 years ago, was different than what it is now.
Right, it was about 30%.
I think that that it's helpful to make an important distinction, which I think is a fundamental distinction between stewardship and fundraising. And if any of you are boards of directors of nonprofit organizations or church stewardship committees, it's really helpful. Fundraising is very simple. It's getting the most amount of money from the least number of people in the shortest period of time. Your question about how is my money being used? Well, those organizations that do that and know how to do it, that's their job. The other saying is, today somebody has to ask somebody for money. That's fundraising. To maximize the amount of money that's being raised. Stewardship is a very different thing. And I won't even play the games about stewardship is all of our talents. Stewardship, when it comes to money, means that everybody participates. It's a participatory experience. The question is not how much was given, but that you gave.
It's the obligation. Your tithe is your obligation. You haven't even given a gift until you've paid your tithe or your obligation.
Okay. Did you hear that? They haven't given a gift until you've gone beyond your tithe. There's one perspective on the continuum.
Well, that comes from giving your tithe and offerings.
Pardon?
Doesn't that come from giving your tithes and offerings to the Lord?
I don't know.
One part and the offering is above.
I'm not a New Testament scholar, so I can't answer that question. But I do know, as a person who I think knows about both of these fairly well, that the motivations and the sense of ownership are very different, and the principles that are operating here, the principles of community, the principles of obligation, the principles of responsibility, the principles of participation. Here in fundraising, and some of you have probably been involved in campaigns, those who give the most get rewarded the most. It's a very secular, left-handed kingdom thing, if you will. If you want to raise more money, you get someone to give a big gift at the beginning, and you make that person extra special. You have all kinds of memorial opportunities. You name windows after folks. You name buildings after folks. You know, recognition is the name of the game in fundraising. And the way to get more recognition is to give more money. Now, we gave money to the zoo, and we've got this nice little plaque. But let me tell you, there, Paul Newman has a plaque that's this big. So you know who gave the most money. There's no... Now, I think that churches have to do both of these, and that's a very difficult task. Most nonprofit organizations don't have to do both of these. But I think churches, to be true to their values and beliefs, have to do both of those.
Steve, I have a comment that I'd like to make.
Sure.
I think that if everyone practiced the biblical stewardship that we should, we would never need fundraising.
That's a good point.
Any figures that are in any community that I've ever been involved in, if you extrapolate the income of the members of that church, if they were to die, you have more money than you could ever use.
But I also know two things. One is that every successful fund drive in both parishes and at the national level is based upon those people who are already giving the most. Those people who give more, the ones you ask are the ones who are already giving to their limit. The second thing is that all of us live in the already, not yet. We already live in God's kingdom. His and her new creation. But the reality is, as Luther reminds us, that we are also sinners. And unfortunately, in every parish, there are lots of sinful people. Some people sin by not tithing. Other people sin by not worshiping regularly. And other people sin by attending too regularly, I guess.
Well,
Anything, tax benefits of giving. They are significant, they're changing. I think that the wills and bequest issue is a, how many people have their wills here? Good, responsible group, jeez. That's an important way to do that. Those of you who are older need to talk about your accountant about giving your money away to your children if you wish. Use of life insurance is another important vehicle that has significant tax benefits. And you can, even if you file a short form, what can you do? You can now deduct 100% of your contributions up to 50% of your income. And that is just next year, that unless they renew the charitable contributions law. Do you have any specific questions about tax benefits? Yes?
Oh, tax benefits to giving one's time.
No. You can deduct 9% for all your volunteer mileage. And I think, let me just say about taxes, I think it's the responsibility of every Christian to pay all the taxes that you owe, but no more.
Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
I know that there is an ethical and a religious reason to be involved in tax resistance, and I applaud those folks that do that. If you choose not to participate in that way, I'd say the best way to tax resist and not go to jail is to pay the least amount of taxes possible. And you do get credit for volunteer mileage. So everybody should have a little logbook in their car, because all of you folks are super responsible Christians who do lots of things for your churches, and you should deduct that. Things you give away, you can deduct. Unless they're really expensive, over $5,000, they have to be valued independently. Yes?
How can I find out about all the things that I can deduct that I don't know about, that I can understand?
Yeah, I think that in every town there are good accountants, and maybe that's the thing that we as parishes need to work harder on at tax time, because it's a whole issue that we avoid, and maybe we need to do that. Robert Sharp and Associates is in Memphis. I'm trying to figure out how the fastest way for you to. I'll try to find that out and put it on the bulletin board. I think if I dig far enough in my memory, I've got his address down. But there's a whole bevy of brochures about tax benefits, and Sharp is not an attorney, so he knows how to write English. That's helpful. I'll try to remember to do that. Yes?
In any discussion, I think, of the eligible deductions.
Yes.
People who tithe or more than tithe are really vulnerable to audit.
Yes.
And I just want to raise the point that keep detailed records.
Yes. Yes.
Because anytime you get over 10%, the feds are looking at you.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But there are ways to, you know, that's the whole issue of who's in control. And if you're in control, you can get through an audit successfully.
So you said up to $5,000, then you had a value. Now the sheet that I got, anything over $500, you give a non-cash contribution, you have to be able to put your values on them.
You may be right. It may be $500 because the amount has gone down each year. That you have to get. So you can give clothing away, that's one thing, but
you have to be able to watch your cost was. If you give over $500, you've got to see what that stuff costs. Well, how many people keep stuff from clothing to give away?
Well, right. But you can, each an article that's worth $500. So if you say this fur coat is worth $500, over $500, then you have to get it independently valued. But if you have $500 worth of clothing over a year's time, you're okay.
But if it's over 500, they'll ask you for a
yes, you're right.
Cost.
You're probably right that it is as low as 500.
I just want to make one other comment that anytime you're talking about the tax deductibility of charitable contributions of any kind, make sure you have current information, because especially in this legislation, there's an awful lot of tax changes going on, and they're really going to hit charitable contributions in those areas. So make sure that you get current information when it's changing on great deal.
It is important to, after having said all this, that in most of the surveys, and they've been done regularly for United Way and other, the last reason people give for making contributions is tax deductibility. And a lot of people give a lot of money without ever reporting it. So taxes obviously aren't the significant reason for it. But we sort of have slid into personal finance and personal management. Maybe we should take about 10 minutes at close to talk about that. It's, as some of you may know, Chuck Lutz from the ALC, the great line that Chuck has, he said, people would better talk about their sex lives than about their checkbooks. That we have something in us that makes it difficult to deal with that issue of money. For some of us, we view money as dirty somehow, it's evil, that it is more than just the root of all evil, it is evil incarnate. For others, there is, some of us have a numbers phobia. Math phobia is very prevalent. Only about 25% of the population can compute unit cost. Somebody said, how many people can read financial statements? 90% of the population can't. Some of us have guilt over money. We've learned that only the evil and corrupt become wealthy, and therefore if you're wealthy, somehow you are evil and corrupt. And for others, an important book called that some of you may have read, a rather popular one, there is the Cinderella Complex, which was, as most of you know, referred to women. That Cinderella waits for Prince Charming, who will save her. I believe very firmly that all of us, both male and female, have that Cinderella complex. And I feel that if I leave the checkbook alone, that somehow Prince Charming is going to come along and balance it and add a little extra money in it, too. So those are some of the causes, I think, that many of us have in difficulty with personal finance. Let me just suggest some things that I have found very helpful and that do refer to financial statements. I get around to my topic at length. Assets and liabilities. What's that called on a financial statement? Anybody know? Or? No?
That's
yeah. Where do assets and liabilities show up on a financial statement?
Balance sheet.
Very good. I am surprised at the large number of parishes that do not have a balance sheet, and many nonprofit organizations operate without them. They offer with what you call a profit or loss. Or income and expense sheet. And one of the things that we've learned reluctantly in our family is that we do have to think in terms of our assets and liabilities. That we need to think about what are our resources and what are our responsibilities. And the reason that I think that's valuable both for individuals and for congregations is that the balance sheet really does hold the future in balance. It gives us a longer-term view, a distant perspective on what it is that we have. I think all of us get so wrapped up in the day-to-day issues of survival and paying the next bill or making more money, as you say. And I think that often, if we took time to list our assets and liabilities, that our priorities would become reoriented both upon the income and the expense side. The other part of that is that we've started to do in our own family is, and for some of you this may be old hat, but is to keep track of both of those things. How many of you know where your money goes each month? You really know? You keep track of it? Good. Boy, this is a compulsive group.
I don't believe them.
You all watch public television too, don't you?
Do they have all lectures on public television?
Another thing we mentioned earlier in terms of personal finances was the use of our tax dollars in terms of both doing that very carefully, seeing that as ministry. And I think that in my own life, that setting aside time to do that and to do it joyfully in one sense and also creatively in another sense is an arena in which all of us as Christians have a ministry. And I urge that strongly. Other issues about personal finance, budgeting as well as personal. Who asked the issue about budgeting? Yes. What specifically about budgeting do you find helpful or not helpful?
Well, just the discipline of budgeting is helpful. But the question I had is, like in a congregation, how would you use a budget? Would you use the budget to keep track of the money, or would you actually use it as a tool to plan your resources or plan your activities for the year?
I think yes.
I know in our church we use the budget to keep track of where the money is going, and we don't do too much. We don't do very good a job of planning the activities based on.
Yeah, I think, and the reason that, and we, one last story about my family, and you get tired. My daughter loved to have people come over to her house to spend the night. And we like to do that because that's part of helping children grow up. But when your daughter asks you on Friday night, can Susan come over, and you've worked all week and you're dead tired, that's the last thing you want to have happen. And so we always say to Rachel, why don't you get that ready on Monday? Why don't you ask Susan on Monday? The problems were, for Rachel, twofold. One is, by the time Friday rolled around, Susan could be her worst enemy. Reality changes in between time. The second thing is Rachel couldn't imagine what life would be like on Friday. It's really hard for us to imagine what the future is going to be like. And I think that's why we have so many problems in budgeting. We don't want to take the risk of making those decisions. I think the best way to do budgeting is to swear that nobody will bring a copy of last year's budget with them. And that you do it creatively and you say, what is it that we want to accomplish next year? Now, what's it going to take to accomplish that? And what's it going to cost to do that? Then ask, how do we get the money to do that? Yeah?
I have a question. If you have a single parent and she has a daughter, I know that I can't give this parent a donation and call it charitable deduction.
That's correct. But you can reduce the size of your estate if you have a large estate.
Yeah. But well, if you'd like her daughter to go to a private school or a church school, could I get around that by making the payments directly to the church school and call it a charitable donation?
No.
Why not? You're giving it to the church.
Because that's not quid for pro, and the whole issue of the school taxes has been dealt with in the last three or 5 years. And you're really funding private education, and that's still not tax deductible. Now, some people get around that by having church schools. And
I'm in a church
school. Yeah. I talk with your accountant to see, and that needs to be done carefully. But it is very risky. Well, the bell's ringing. We almost did it. And thank you very much. Look forward to talking to you again.